broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. You're listening to Full Service Radio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis. Glad to have you with us tonight.
Hi. Yes,
hi.
It's always nice to say hi to your wife on the radio.
Yeah.
How you doing? So, those of you who know us from our local show here in the D.C. area, Foodie and the Beast, that's kind of a live...
it's a party.
Variety show party on broadcast radio where we got drinks, we got guests, we got famous chefs,
we
got
food. We've been on for 9 years. We've been doing it a long time.
We've been on for 9.5 years.
9.5 years,
yeah.
It's true.
So now we're on Full Service Radio with a show that's an hour format that's a deeper dive into a single subject, and which is great because it gives us a chance to show how brainy we are.
Well, I'm that's brainy. Not why we're doing it this way. The real reason why we're doing it is because it actually gives us an opportunity to take some of the guests that we have on Foodie and the Beast or other guests that maybe don't make sense for Foodie and the Beast and bring them into the show and really have an interesting conversation about a topic that really works for
is
us.
Is that why we're doing this?
Yes, that's why. Well, that's why I'm doing
right.
it. I have no idea why
I'm
you're
just here.
Here
for the free food.
That's
okay.
What I figured. There's
so
no free
tonight,
food
tonight. Though, we're tackling a subject of consuming interest. To me and to a lot of people, and that's coffee. And our guest tonight knows the subject cold. Back in 2008, she wrote a book called God in a Cup, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Coffee. She's Michael Weissman, and she really saw coffee becoming a trend, and we'll get into how that happened. And she jumped on board because she's aggressively acquisitive, and she sort of took the subject matter for herself, and she's written articles and books, and she's an expert. Hi, Michael. How are you?
Hi, Michael.
Fine. It's nice to be here.
It's nice to have you on the show. Also, later, Reggie Elliott is going to be joining us. He is with Spike Gertie's new fabulous coffee shop,
The Cup We All Race For. Yes.
Did you want to race me to say that?
I did.
Okay. You lost.
The Cup We All Race For. No, I got it out first. I win.
And he's anyway, he's doing the coffee program at the Line Hotel, and he's going to be bringing in some delicious coffees for us to try. We're actually going to be doing a cupping in studio, which will allow us to sniff and swirl just like we were tasting wine.
Yeah, I'll be drinking it, but that's okay.
Instead, we're going to be doing coffee.
I'm going to start with a question because Nikki is not a heavy coffee drinker. I am.
I was at one point.
And in fact, my day... Are you trying to see me? It won't happen.
Okay.
If my day doesn't start if I don't get at least one cup in, and I usually drink about 4 cups between getting up and noon. But you
don't care about the taste. But
that isn't true. Why are you dissing me already?
I'm not dissing you, but you are not one of those people
who really...
Well, a
Keurig does not turn out great-tasting coffee.
And you don't
but
care.
We have a Keurig, and I don't have time to wait for the stuff to...
I know, I'm just saying. It's not a priority for you.
All right, don't hurt me so
early. Taste is not a priority.
May I speak?
Go ahead,
so here's the question, because I love coffee, and I need it, and if I don't drink it, I get a headache, so I'm a junkie.
Okay, ask the question.
Can a cup of coffee reveal the face of God? I mean, that's in the title of your book.
And it's in the title of the book because at a coffee competition about 10 years ago, one of the really sublime palates in the industry tasted a new coffee, which is now, it's called Geisha, and it's now very famous and very expensive, and lots of people know about it. And he said, although I am not a religious man, I have seen the face of God in a cup. Now, is this a good title for a book about coffee?
He's Mr. Hyperbole, probably.
Well, it was a very interesting coffee, and I like to write about people who are obsessed. And he was obsessed, and many people in coffee world are profoundly obsessed. And they know, they have a level of sensitivity in their palates, which, you know, takes them into sublime directions.
Well, coffee's changed the world, too. I mean,
but I think we should start at the beginning of coffee, because when the United States was founded, we were tea drinkers.
Yes, we were tea drinkers.
So when did that all change?
Oh, well, it changed
the Boston
during
Tea Party.
Precisely. It's so nice to be married to a clever guy.
Right. It also helps that it's in the notes, but go ahead.
No, it's not. It's not in my notes,
okay.
And I have a master's degree in American history. You think I didn't learn that?
Okay.
Anyway.
You know, the Boston Tea Party and the tea when it floated in the... because the colonists didn't want to pay taxes, and coffee was cheaper to import coffee came from it came from Latin America. It was grown in the Caribbean starting in the 1700s. So it was actually a shorter import than tea.
But wasn't I read in your book that all coffee really started in
Yemen. In Ethiopia.
It actually started in Ethiopia, then Yemen took over. But are all strands of coffee based off of the coffee from those two countries?
Yes, but they've been, you know, the DNA has been hybrid. Worked in and hybrid and all that. But yes, it evolved wild in Ethiopia. And it's research on the genetics of coffee are just beginning to be going on now, but it is believed that coffee continues to evolve. So new cultivars continue to appear in Ethiopia, but because of development, you know, there's less forest land, and there's worry about that process continuing.
Does anybody have any idea how and why the first cup was brewed and drunk? Because growing on the vine, you can't do anything with it. I mean, on the plant, you can't do anything with it. And then it's a plant. And then
it's a plant or a tree?
It's a tree. It's a small tree.
I'm right, but I mean, a tree's a plant. Yeah. I'm just saying, growing that way.
Oh my God.
All right. Well, you know what?
Am I married to both of you? Good Lord. Anyways, my point is, sitting on the tree, it doesn't look very delicious and it doesn't taste delicious. So how did that work? Was there a forest fire and then it dropped in water? I mean,
the story, the legend, which is told and retold and retold, is about a young shepherd watching his goats become sort of drunk, nibbling on the ripe cherry, which turns red when it's ready. So nibbling on that cherry and becoming drunk, and then thinking, well, I want some of that too. And that's the
if
legend.
If the goats are buzzed, then we should be buzzed.
Right. But the truth of the matter is that human beings, when things are growing wild, human beings taste them and figure it out. What's interesting is that the traditional ways of preparing coffee in Ethiopia and in Yemen are not ones that are so palatable to us. What's done now is a kind of charring, and sort of you char the beans and then grind them and then make an infusion in boiled water, and so you get a very burnt beverage. But that's, you know, we all like what we like.
So right. Was that around what time was in Yemen? Let's say in Ethiopia, when did they start drinking coffee?
Coffee started to be exported around 1600, 1500. Oh, yeah, it was around the time that Vienna was falling to the infidels. You know,
so were the
1600-ish.
Turks already drinking coffee?
Yeah.
They'd already picked it up.
Yeah, exactly.
So okay, so the Boston Tea Party happens in the States.
Right.
But coffee is in the States, and they're getting it. They're importing it from Costa Rica.
No.
Oh,
from it's small islands off the Caribbean where it's being
It was on Nevis, wasn't it?
And there's an island called Revenue, which I don't even know where it is, but teeny. But it was being grown. It was being grown in the Caribbean by Catholic priests who had basically stolen the beans. So
interesting, fascinating.
Yes, it's well. The economics of coffee industry are extremely fascinating and totally intertwined with colonialism, completely and continue to be, to some extent.
Well, especially when you think about where coffee is grown
exactly.
These days.
Right, economic colonialism, sure.
Yeah, well, yeah. Economic colonialism and colonialism itself. Actually.
Well, so when you talk today, I mean, just in the past, you know, year in D.C. alone, all these new coffee places have opened up. And, you know, you have Spike's Place right in front of us, but La Colombe, and you have Compass and Blue Note and
Gregory's just opened.
Right. So you have all these shops. But they're, I guess, for the uninitiated with coffee who aren't diehards, they're all getting beans. Are they roasting their beans? Like, what's the process? What's going on here?
Okay. What's going on here is that when you have a market and when people see that they can make money, and when you have an industry that you can enter with relatively small amounts of capital and a product that young people like to drink, well, of course, because would you rather go to work for Procter & Gamble or would you rather start a cool
Well, if I could be CEO.
Well, coffee company.
You kind of jumped from the first wave to the third wave.
Right.
I mean, here, let's take it up to World War II, because in every World War II movie, they're smoking cigarettes, bad boys, and they're trying to heat up coffee in a helmet and all that. So coffee became the drink.
Yes.
And even when I was a kid, which is back in olden times, tea was for when you were sick, and otherwise everybody in the house drank coffee.
Well, and not only that, but and pretty high quality coffee, which is the funny thing, because all those chains like AMP bought pretty good beans and roasted them themselves and sold them, and you could either, do you remember, but in the supermarkets they had little grinders,
yep.
But that was pretty high quality coffee, because that model predates the industrialization of the food supply. So you had...
Even back in,
We're talking about the 30s and the 40s. Because it's in the 50s when Sanka and Nescafe ruins the whole notion of what coffee should taste like. Because of instant, exactly.
All right, and so you had the Maxwell houses and the chock full of nuts and all that, and they were just big. They're the big...
Well, that's a slightly different thing. Before you had the Maxwell houses and the chock full of nuts, you had supermarkets that imported coffee and sold it
to
their customers.
Were they roasting it themselves?
Yeah, and they were roasting it themselves.
So Acme buyers would go to down to these countries themselves?
No. They would deal with large importers who dealt with... They deal with large importers who bought from, as was described to me, men in white suits who sat...
I got you.
You know, the colonialists
like
who went around and...
It's like bananas.
Yeah.
I got you.
They bought the beans for cheap and sold them for more and made a lot of money for themselves, and the farmers got poorer and poorer. And we can't really blame them, because that's the way the world worked. I mean, we can blame them, but... and so prior, say through World War II... If you tasted a cup of the coffee that Americans were drinking, they might have prepared it badly, but the coffee was pretty high-quality coffee. Comes post-World War II, and we get Wonder Bread, and we get the industrialization of the food supply. And then the quality of American coffee starts to really go down, because convenience is the god. And instead of having your A&P roast it, you're having huge companies that are maybe not buying the best beans, and they're advertising nationally. And then you have this horrible thing called instant coffee, which is still drunk.
What is instant coffee?
It's just kind of coffee turned into, I don't know.
A powder, right?
A powder, yeah, exactly. And then freeze-dried, they used to say.
Right, whatever that means.
Whatever that means, exactly. But
dust.
Yeah, and then what happened? So that there, you've got this industrialization going on one level, but you have a lot of Germans and Northern Europeans who came to the United States from Northern Europe, where they drink a lot of coffee because it's so dark and drear. And they came from a real coffee tradition, and they, like 60s and 70s, Alfred Peet, for example, while the coffee tradition is dying, the American coffee tradition is dying, these Europeans, based largely in California, are reintroducing a coffee tradition and starting a fire that's going to catch and catch and catch and turn into Starbucks, and then going to turn into what we call the third wave, which is just the latest iteration of the specialty coffee industry.
But let's back up before we hit the third wave. What the second wave was the Peet's and the Starbucks, but what was it that they were actually doing?
Okay, so what they were doing, and it starts with Alfred Peet is a really interesting guy, because he was European. He came here after the war with nothing, but he knew about coffee roasting, and he knew about quality beans, and he started importing. And this is a secret to the way Starbucks roasts, because he roasted the way Northern Europeans roasted at the time, which is a very dark roast. And when you go into Starbucks and you order coffee and it sort of tastes a little burnt, that's because that's a tradition. And so Alfred Peet became both a roaster and a retailer. And he had an impact on the West Coast of the United States. Now, previously, anyone who has ever read any beatnik literature from the 1950s, like Jack Kerouac, there were coffee houses in North Beach of San Francisco, and they were making the espresso kind of on the Italian model. So this Alfred Peet isn't.
So wait a minute, are you saying that Allen Ginsberg's Howl was written on caffeine and not on drugs? Is that what you're saying?
You can't do both.
This
sweetheart.
Is new history.
We get the uppers, we get the downers, we get the whole range.
Right.
Well, I have a question.
Okay, ask it.
This is a little pop, culture stuff. Where did the phrase "cup of Joe" come from? Was that during World War II? And why is it Joe? And how did Java get in there? Does Java make?
Oh,
do they grow coffee?
Mocha Java is a kind of coffee, and coffee comes from Indonesia.
So I want a cup of Java.
That's a mocha Java is a blend. Is a pretty famous blend.
And
actually,
why a cup of Joe?
You know, I don't know the
answer.
G.I.
Joe.
I don't know.
That's probably it.
Yeah. Go ahead. Reggie has just joined
us
in studio.
But he didn't bring any coffee.
Not yet. It's coming. Okay, so in this second wave, Starbucks starts, Pete's, you have all these coffees, and they get really big. But then...
Yes, they do get big. I mean, but what really happens is that they get... I mean, besides that, they grow an industry for themselves, but they get people interested. But okay, so... We now have, besides the industrial coffee, we have some high-quality coffee being roasted and sold in this country. And then, in the 90s, we have a lot of economic things that change. And one of them is that travel overseas becomes really cheap, and communications become much more readily available. So instead of this centralized system of large-scale importers dealing with large-scale aggregators at origin, you can suddenly have literally guys in sandals who put a backpack on their shoulders for not a lot of money, go to origin and start talking to farmers and say, I'm going to buy... they talk to the farmers, but they also really talk to the co-ops because nobody really deals, well, mostly one-on-one with farmers. But that's a complicated statement I just made. They can buy 500 pounds of coffee. They have to ship it back through an importer. But this economic system that was a megalith, that was not assailable because you had big guy dealing with big guy, suddenly had there was a possibility of entering the industry as a small person.
Well, let me just jump in. When you say big guy dealing with big guy, these small farmers in, let's say, in Costa Rica or wherever, were their crops being bought by essentially an aggregator who was then putting everything together and selling it to Safeway?
You had several systems. You had co-ops who were basically aggregators. You had coyotes who went around and just bought up. See, it's agriculture always comes down to banking. You know that farmers never have enough money to pay for their crops, so they borrow money. So then a coyote comes along and says, I'll give you,
X,
5 cents on the pound, but you can have it right now. Oh. And the farmer is broke and he has to pay back his bank or blah, 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 blah.
It sounds like a wily coyote.
Yeah, right. Well, exactly, because it's, I mean, the way the system works is that the smallest person, the grower, always
gets
is at
screwed.
A disadvantage.
Right,
exactly. So,
but with the growth of this third wave, which wasn't called a third wave, I assume, when it was starting.
No, it was not.
But you're really talking about direct trade now, where people go and they want,
I wouldn't go there exactly. I mean, we're talking about smaller scale roasters having access to the market in a more flexible way. Direct trade is a term that gets thrown around as something else, but they are able to buy identified lots of coffee, and they start, and so you get a whole bunch of small roasting companies recognizing this opportunity and springing up, and then the situation we're in now is that it's expanded geometrically.
Well, what's interesting, I mean, it's sort of, it does really parallel the beer world, because at the beginning you had Budweiser and Miller and Coors, and then you had, I mean, the first craft brew was Anchor Steam out of San Francisco, and Anchor Steam and Sierra Nevada and all those guys, and then they got big. And then there were all these craft brewers who were kind of doing it at home, and they said, I'm tired of the taste of those. I can do better than that.
But also the laws changed. The laws changed in D.C. specific.
Well, the laws changed because they got lobbied by people who wanted them to change.
Right, but that's my point. Like, there was a lot of change in government laws that allowed breweries to start.
But what drove it was people who were coming basically out of the bathtub, you know, their bathtub brews, and wanting to start their own craft breweries. Yes. Like the guys from Three Stars.
No, I understand where you're going with it, but I think my question is, what I find most interesting about the third wave is that there was such a huge coffee market with the Starbucks at that point in time, and the Peet's and Green Mountain. You know, there were these big behemoths that have sort of started changing the way we were all looking at coffee. That what I'm most impressed
created opportunity for
right.
this.
Well, see, that's the part that I'm amazed by, because I would think that the space would have felt swollen and that there was too much there. That I'm so, like, it's so interesting that all these smaller companies were like, no, I'm going to come in, I'm going to do a brick and mortar.
Well, but what Michael said is a point. Like Starbucks, I go to Starbucks because it's almost a lifestyle thing. But their coffee is burnt, and they do it purposefully so it'll be universal and uniform around the world.
And it stands up to milk,
right? Didn't a lot of these people say, "God, I'm sick of tasting that stuff. I can do better than that."
Well, sure, exactly. And I think you have a lot of different. I mean, you had a moment when people were looking for meaning. Coffee is very interesting, as is craft beer, because these are small luxuries. So you can have something special and you can afford it. And you don't have to earn a lot of money. And you can know about something that nobody else knows about. And it can be extremely elite on that level, but very democratic, because so...
Were there coffee clubs, like there were beer clubs originally for the little home brewers and all that? Did it become...
Well, I don't think a lot. Well, actually, we had a roaster on Foodie and the Beast who started roasting her own coffee in her house before she's in Frederick. She was a policewoman before she began roasting and created a roastery.
The cop with the coffee.
Well, and the coffee club, it was what you're saying was interesting about it, because my husband is sitting here in the corner. And one of the things that got me interested in writing about coffee, and this goes back 10 years ago, was John came home from work one day and said, you know, they started a coffee club at the University of Maryland where he was a professor. And John doesn't even like coffee. But he said, I'm going to join because they get to taste all these different interesting things. And in the same week, my best friend told me that she was sneaking up into the executive offices of the Wall Street Journal because they had better coffee. And I went, oh, coffee. Aha, something's going on in coffee. And that
when was this?
Probably my first story was in 2006. It might 2005, 2006 were the first stories I wrote about coffee.
We should add, by the way, your husband wasn't just a professor at the University of Maryland. He was a professor of physics, which means he's a brainiac. Look at you, John. He's smiling.
Electrical engineering, but yes, I mean, life is way too short to live with a boring man, right?
Right.
You need someone who's got something to say. Something going on.
Is that right?
I guess so.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
I'll give her that. Woo. How about that?
All right. Thank God.
Well, so what got you? We haven't really gotten to what got you to write the story of God in a cup.
Well, I just kept following the story. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think the very first story I did was for the Washington Post, and it was a story called "The Upscaling of Office Coffee." I mean, you know, where do ideas come? They come from, you steal them from around yourself. But when I started talking to people who were in the business, you know, there's this thing that happens when you realize, oh, there's something really going on here. There's some energy. This isn't just business. This is passion. And that's what happened. I started talking to people, and I did that story. And then I was doing a story for the New York Times on also coffee entrepreneurs and these young guys taking over the business, I guess. And somebody said to me, you're not going to know about anything about coffee unless you go to Origin. And I said, all right, well, I'm going to go to Origin. It was just,
So where did
you
go?
So what does Origin mean?
I went to a coffee competition in Nicaragua. Because somebody's there's this thing called Cup of Excellence, and it was available. And you wouldn't want to invent the wheel as a journalist. You want to go where there's a story, and a whole lot of people are centralized, and that's what it did. And I met all the people who are the main characters of God in a Cup, and who still, to a large extent, are movers and shakers in the industry. Although now, what's funny about the third wave is now in my writing, I have to call that we're in. Do we call it the fourth wave?
I was going
to
say,
do we call it three and a half?
Like, are we still in the third wave? Because your book is from 2008, right?
Yes, and the guys that I wrote about last year, I did this long series for an online publication called Sprudge, and they were in middle school when the guys I write about were being these coffee revolutionaries, because time marches on. So, in fact, the industry has changed tremendously in 10 years. Some of the attitudes, some of the hip stuff continues. The idea that coffee is, it has a certain patina of youth and alternative, but also hip wazee, and I know the inside scoop, and you don't, and I'm cooler than you.
Well, everybody wants to be an expert.
Everybody wants to be the coolest guy in school. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't? Right. We know that Reggie is the coolest guy.
Not at all. Right.
Well, okay, so Reggie, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to get into your 411, because our understanding is you are the barista's barista, and we want to hear what that really means, and then we're going to do a little cupping in studio. This is David and Nikki Nellis.
Cupping sounds wrong, doesn't
it? Industry Night with Tasting. Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
It's called a cupping. We'll be back in a second.
And today's break music, courtesy of Kido, K-I-E-D-O, on SoundCloud. Enjoy, it's called Bring a Little Love. We'll be right back with Industry Night.
All right, we're back on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis. We've got Michael Weissman, who is... Jesus Christ superstar when it comes to coffee. She knows everything about it. And Reggie Elliott, I would call you Judas, but that's not a good thing to be. But you're close. You're an apostle of coffee. And Reggie, you're here at the hotel. You work for Spike Gurdy, who, am I saying it right, Gurdy?
I think it's Gurdy. It's a
tough name. Can he be Spike Smith? The name of the coffee shop is the cup we all race for.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But your background is pretty. You've
been in the coffee biz for a long time.
Dude's got a PhD in coffee, right?
About 10. This is year 10, actually, right now.
How did you get into coffee?
Are you a caffeine freak? Is that what?
Actually, no. I drink it, but I'm not a freak. I'm from D.C. I grew up in the area, but I'd lived in... This is like back in 07. I lived in Baltimore for a year and kind of got tired of it. So when I came back to D.C., I was looking for just a different line of work. I'd been doing retail for a while. So I was like, what else is there where I still get to interact with people, because I love that part of it? And I saw a quirky little ad on Craigslist for a coffee shop called Murky.
Right. I remember when that opened.
And I think previously I remember it being, was it Common Ground or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
I remember that too. But yeah, started with Murky Coffee,
But when you started with coffee, much like when we were talking about with Michael, she saw a story, mm-hmm. and that's what spurred her interest. I assume with you it had to do with taste and texture and smell, and there must have been something there.
Or just a job?
Probably initially, but not now.
I'd say it was the vibe of the coffee shop. I had a background in film, so like anywhere I could be involved with creative people, I knew... A coffee shop would be the best place to do that.
Can I just it's interesting because what Starbucks has done is they brought the customer into the creative thing. Give me a Frappuccino with a Dinga Donga and a Dooga Daga. It's my own special blend.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because they offer you the opportunity to paint your own palette.
Yes.
But you have a pretty interesting resume. I mean, you were with La Colombe.
Mm-hmm.
And so where would you say you got your best coffee education?
That's a really good question.
I am full of good questions. Just get me started.
And self-confidence.
Like professional
yes.
Oh, that's a really good question. I'd say, honestly, overall, I don't think there is one single place. I think it just takes...
But Nick is a great place to
I mean,
start.
Nick was, yeah, you can't.
Murky Coffee.
Nick is like a professor.
Because he was the first, that was the first great coffee I ever drank up until
And what that, was it about it, that coffee that was so good?
It was a god shot. It was a cappuccino. I was like David. I drank coffee as boiled water and Ritalin. And then, and you think that what you're drinking is great, and then one day, you walk into a cafe, and someone says, I told him I wanted blah blah to drink. I was already working on a story,
mm-hmm.
and Nick said, "Can I make you something good?" That
I love
he,
that.
Oh, and he
how
was,
could you say no to
of
that?
Of course. And he had so much personality and so mm-hmm. much passion and so much knowledge.
And he still does.
And he still does. And I've seen him in California, and he made me this cappuccino that with the first of all with the little design the mm-hmm. Rosetta design, but. And that's all lovely, and it had texture and fragrance.
Well, that's a really great point.
And yeah. It didn't taste like anything I had ever tasted.
Well, I don't want your coffee to get cold, right. So do you want to pour one first,
sure.
So you can tell us what we're trying?
Yeah.
So what are we starting with?
Let's start with the Hama from it's Ethiopian coffee.
Okay. Now, have you been there, Michael?
Yes,
you have been there. So what was that like being there?
Well, Ethiopia is Mecca
yes.
for coffee lovers.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to understand, you're going to taste this coffee now, and it's got what coffee people call good acidity, good brightness.
Okay.
So this is, I think... First of all, they have a fabulous array of coffees. They have very delicious coffees, but it's also the source of tremendous amount of romance and
mm-hmm.
storytelling because it emerged here.
Well, it smells delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean,
uh-oh, she's about to come over from the dark side.
No, I mean, I can totally appreciate coffee. I do appreciate it.
Mm.
So what are we looking for here? Oh, it smells like blueberries.
That's what you're looking for.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's I love pouring this one for people who are curious about what we're serving because it smells like blueberries because it has this super strong fruit
but it's flavor. got a bite to it.
Yeah.
Well, that's the good acidity that is surprising if you're not used to it. If you're not.
But I think it's really mellow. There's no sharpness
right.
to
See,
it.
That's right.
Your whole point about when Americans started really traveling abroad and not just to Europe but around and because. I mean, the first time I had real I drank coffee before, but it was always Maxwell House or something. I lived in Italy for a while, and when I drank, coffee over there, it was like, holy shit, this is
It's a revelation.
Different. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It changes
Well, because
lives.
There's also, I think maybe when you're in Europe or Turkey or other countries that revere their coffee and revere their products, the U.S. is in a real transition for the last really 20 years about respecting our food and where it comes from and taking real care and having craft artisans. And it is part of the coffee explosion that's going on here. But Europeans have always felt that way about, not just our coffee, but anything they put on their table. And I think that's what, when you go to Europe, that's what you see. And you want to take some of that home with you. This is delicious. Now, when you drink a cup like this...
Mm-hmm.
Do you ruin it by putting milk into it? Is this something that's supposed to be black? I mean, this needs no sugar.
Like 5 to 6 years ago, I would have said yes. But like as I've gone on, I've experienced different... I lived in Sweden for 6 years. I experienced the way different cultures drink coffee. I've learned that... I've changed my mind. Now, as far as I'm concerned, once I put that in the cup and give it to you and the money's been changed...
It's all up to you.
It's your coffee now.
Right.
It's coffee is a personal experience.
But does milk or cream or sugar... I mean, it changes your taste, but does it enhance the coffee? Do we know where adding milk to coffee came from? Yes?
No, I would wanted to answer that question.
Okay.
There are coffees that really that speak to milk very beautifully.
Right,
the Latin American coffees, which are chocolatey and nougaty and nutty, they They have a natural affinity for milk. And I tend to buy, I tend to drink coffees like we just tasted, coffee black and in the afternoon, early afternoon. And I tend to drink Latin Americans in the morning because I like milk first thing. There, it goes down easy. Mm-hmm. It's kind of there's a real delight in milk and coffee, right?
Yeah, like I don't necessarily drink it, but when I job before here was with La Colombe, and their house coffee, it just they chose it because it goes well with milk.
Okay.
You can drink it straight, but like it's when you put milk in it, it changes it. It adds like this chocolate flavor.
Now, where are all your coffees from?
The ones we have on the table, they're all from, they're actually all African coffees.
Okay.
Both the.
And who do you work with?
Well, I work for Spike.
The no, coffee, no, no, no. I know you.
The coffee we use is from Counterculture.
Counterculture. Mm-hmm. And so do they roast the beans to your, like, do they roast the beans to your specification? How does it all work?
They tend to roast everything to a medium to light roast. That's just their style,
okay.
Which is why we work with them.
So they get different beans from different areas,
yes.
Roast them, and that's how you come up with them.
Yeah.
Do you ever get mad science-y and mix them together? Like, do you play?
I wouldn't do that.
Okay.
I do it though. Especially if I'm not so crazy about a specific particular.
Well, let me ask a question.
I wouldn't do it to a guest. With a guest.
Right. Nikki and I work with a vineyard, and the winemaker there, the owner, his whole philosophy is that great wines are made out in the vineyard, that the processing should be very a light touch and all that. So is that essentially true with coffee? The point of origin is really and all the acidity that comes from how the tree grows, et cetera, et cetera. And your roasting should be light or medium and not burned. Like Starbucks is sometimes.
But first, you've got
with the beans.
Yeah,
right?
you've got.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
Right. Yeah, well, there's a fermentation process in most coffee, which people don't realize.
No, how do you do that?
Coffee is a fermented product.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so, before I answer how you do it, and Reggie can answer too. Coffee is an unbelievably complicated yes. product to grow, to process, to ship, and to roast, and to serve. And it is amazing to me that anyone ever drinks a good cup of coffee because it is not simple.
Is it a fragile process?
Yeah. And
or is it a pain in the neck?
Well, first of all, it's damp. You pick the beans. Do they start to ferment? I mean, not the good kind of ferment. Do they start to go rotty when you put them down on the... In Africa, often the beans are just put on the ground till
right.
they're collected up. I mean, is the bean picked when it's ripe? Does it degrade after it's picked? Is it stored in a dry, not smelly place without any, you know, mold? And at fermentation... There's numerous fermentation methods, but is there too much water in the fermentation? Is it too cold? Is it too short? Is there not enough? Does it go rotty again? I mean, it's just, and then there's this thing called, there are beans that are, that naturally occur that are called Quakers that just
yes.
taste like garbage.
Well, there's always a bad nut in the bunch. You know, like when you're eating almonds or
right.
peanuts or something, like you can be eating them and they're so good, but there's always that one.
I've been described as that, actually.
Yes, that's also true.
So
he's a bad
but
nut.
But if you grind it, then you
why is it
think,
called a Quaker? Go back to right. that. That sounds like a diss.
That one, do you know the origin of the term? Because I just know it.
I don't know the origin of the term either, no. But I know that counterculture actually is working on some technological fixes to identify Quakers before the coffee is roasted. So that
they can be pulled out.
Yes. I mean, because it's also that the coffee, once you pick it, it keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And so the picker who's paid for a pound of cherry... called cherry, you know, it's probably a proportion of maybe 25% when you roast a bean, the relative, is that right?
This is all right, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it is crazy complicated, and I'm just constantly amazed that any coffee is ever...
I want to take... let's, while you're pouring the next one to taste, let's talk a little bit about...
Can they use that as a dump cup?
The farmers.
Hello?
Yeah, you can use that as a dump cup.
I mean, I drank all mine.
Let's talk about the farmers, because my sense of it is the people that end up getting screwed in the food chain are usually the little farmers in a little country somewhere.
Well, isn't that where fair trade came from? Wasn't that part of the third
wave? Well, it's
wave?
Fair trade fair and all that. And the,
well, yeah, there's, I mean, fair trade and there's direct trade.
Right, but here's my question, because the word organic has been footballed around and it's used by people. It's marketing. And it's been used, fair trade is used in chocolate like a football too, and it's not really fair trade, a lot of it. So what's the deal in the world of coffee for the little farmer in Nicaragua somewhere that's trying to grow coffee?
Well, okay. So first of all, in Latin America...
Or anywhere.
Well, in Latin America, it's a little bit better.
Okay.
Because they're closer to the market.
Right.
A lot of people speak Spanish. It's a more developed market. There have been major efforts in the last 10 years to encourage farmers to grow higher quality coffee and promise them that if they grow higher quality, they will make a better living. This is a work in progress. All the other programs, fair trade, direct trade, blah, 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 they're all related to that. Please grow better beans and we will give you, you will make a better living.
Is it bullshit or is it true?
It's not bullshit where it isn't bullshit. There are programs that are really successful and serious and are making a difference. In en masse, the living... I'm blabbering so loud. But the living of coffee farmers around the world en masse is probably getting worse, not better, tragically. But there are programs where farmers are doing better. There are definitely farmers who are really prospering.
Do the politics of the farm growing country come to play here? In other words, if there's a despot running the thing, is he cutting deals and the farmers are getting screwed? I got a lot of nods happening.
well, I'd say yes. Like that's. it's funny because two of the coffees here are from Burundi. That's a coffee that's only recently you're starting to see coffee.
What is the coffee? Can you say the coffee?
Right now we're drinking the Buzira Guhindwa. Which is from Burundi.
That's easy for you to say.
It's from Burundi.
It took me like one full night of practice.
So it's from Burundi?
Yeah. Okay. As is the Kigoma, actually. So two of the coffees are Burundi.
Wait, this is really clean.
It smells like chocolate.
Yeah, I like this one.
I think it smells like chocolate.
Some chocolate. It's got some like black tea in there.
I think it smells plaid.
Hey.
There you go.
But this is really amazing, because 10 years ago, or eight, when I was in Burundi, they weren't producing coffee with...
There's a lot of like potato defect.
Yeah, yeah. They're so clean and beautiful as this.
What does that mean, potato?
It would taste like potato. Just because it was so under... I guess because it was so underdeveloped.
How important is terroir when it comes to your coffee bean? I mean, we talk about it all the time with wine. Is it as important to the different regions?
Yeah, absolutely. It plays as much a role in coffee as it does in wine. I have a nickname with the wine team up at Race. We call ourselves the Terroir Squad because it's a big it impacts both of our, you know, what we do. So it's very important.
Is everyone terrorified? Thank you.
Terroirist.
Well, anyway. You know, you brought up earlier, you know, actually, Michael, you did, when you went to Murky and, you know, you had this drink and they did this beautiful
little
rosette on top, which is, you know, latte art is an exploding. There are competitions you're involved with that. So can you explain a little bit about that? Because when I first learned about that a couple of years ago, I was like, what is going on here? What are these people doing? So can you explain it? Because you guys work so hard.
Yeah. I'll try to do it briefly, but basically it's a community building activity more than anything. It's a chance for baristas to kind of do what they do for a living, but to do it for fun and to do it with from around the city. But essentially, it's a tournament style competition. You pour,
what is it called? TNT?
It's called TNT, Thursday Night Throwdown.
Okay, Thursday Night Throwdown. Go
Where
ahead.
Where do you do it?
We do it all around the city. It
moves around.
Second Thursday of every month. It's at various cafes all throughout the city. It's a chance for baristas to hang out and like maybe pick up some pointers, maybe find a job lead. but it's a chance to kind of just hang out, drink beer.
But you're also doing the artwork.
And that's the whole competition. It's you pour whatever you can, set it down. The judges are blind. They open their eyes. They pick whatever cup they like the most out of. It's purely picturesque.
It has nothing to do with the taste of the coffee.
Nothing
correct?
To do with the taste. It's purely aesthetics.
And was that something? Where did that come from? What's the origins of that?
I believe the first throwdown started in, I want to say it was in Sweden, actually, in Gothenburg. Kind of like, it was a barista competition or something.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone just kind of gathered and they just started making, they just really just kind of started doing it.
I mean, it's sort of a natural thing. The cocktail, the mixologists do it.
No, absolutely.
But you know that, I mean, but it's the art is created largely just by the
right,
vibrations.
The shaking. Yes. Right.
It's really quite.
It's fascinating to watch.
No etching is allowed. Right. Some artists, they do a lot of things.
Oh, they put like a stick in?
Totally
no. This is all by how you pour. It's all in the wrist, right?
Yeah, it's all. That's right.
It's really cool.
But it's also, it's young people who, so people are devoting their lives to being baristas and coffee, and they're not going to make a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you... But it's
Reggie.
It's artisan work.
He's like, hey, I got a job here.
And don't worry, Spike's listening somewhere.
But it's being an artisan. They're artisans, and the throwdowns are about celebrating being artisans and having values that are somewhat different from the rest of the society, right?
Yeah, I'd say 10 years ago, when I got the job, I didn't see myself doing this 10 years from now. But then I learned a whole new skill set, you know, because I learned how to make coffee here. When I went to Sweden, I had a skill set, and Swedes drink tons of coffee. So it was like, I actually have a valuable, somewhat skill set.
Why leave? That's the question.
That's another episode.
So now you're a part of this whole program, and you have created the coffee program here.
Yes.
As you were sourcing your coffee and your tastes, what was it that you were looking to do? And like, what do you use for espresso and How do you pick all that?
I have a really good team. I have a couple of supervisors that work for me. One of them is over there right now. His name is Ben.
Mm-hmm.
He's a younger barista. He's competed in a couple of competitions as well. He's really into brewing and the science of coffee. So I've trusted Ben's. I trusted their palate for the most part to pick the coffees.
Sounds like a diss to Ben just a little bit there.
Hmm? No. It's like Ben's palate is. Ben's younger, more into it. Yeah, I think it's better to make it more collaborative. I have another barista, Victoria. She's our training supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
So it's we do it collectively. I can't possibly take all the credit.
This goes to both of you, actually. So, you know, years and years ago, there were only, you know, you got your coffee, you know, through a Mr. Coffee machine or a percolator at a party. But now there's all these different ways to brew your coffee.
Well, and what's the Italian espresso maker that's the...
La Mazzocco that I'm writing about.
You have one?
Yes.
So what is it... Like, what's that? And what are all these different ways? And I want both of your opinion. Like, when you're making a cup of coffee at home, how do you do it versus how you prefer it when you're out?
Okay. Well, I do a pour over because it's a very simple... Not technological. I have actually two ways I make coffee at home. I do a simple pour over with a ceramic, a blue bottle ceramic, you know, because it goes a little slower. But I also, I do have a coffee maker that I bought from the Intelligentsia website. And I'm blanking on the name. It's German. That just produces a really high quality cup of...
Pressure based? Is it the pressure? What
no,
is it?
Is it a machine?
Yeah, and it's able to. I paid about $250 and I got a really good coffee maker, and it's called Therma. It's made in Germany. This is so embarrassing. But
it's okay.
I'm not going to remember the name of it. But what it really does is it controls the temperature exquisitely, and that's what you do. That's what I'm paying.
Yep.
The German engineering, so that the temperature is controlled beautifully, and I get gorgeous coffee. But I don't. It's big. I don't want it on my counter because I like clean line.
I'm going to go home and pound our Keurig with a sledgehammer.
Please do.
I mean, the problem is there's nothing else that I know of that makes a cup of coffee that quickly. You know, you just want to get it and drink it and move on.
It's understandable.
When you when you use a Keurig, are you getting as much caffeine from those little things as you would?
Okay. Who knows? That's like a whole other show to start talking about caffeine.
I've got two all pros here. Okay. I need to know.
Okay, so let's pour our last cup of coffee. All
right.
And I will, while I'm pouring, I will say that if you look over at our counter, you'll see these two
machines.
Yes.
Okay, so tell us about them.
Those are called SP9s, a.k.a. Splurdy. They are from this company called Marco. And what they do is, pour it. They actually control the temperature.
Okay.
Just like Michael was saying. You'll see the water shoot up into this top chamber and kind of swirl around in a whirlpool. And what that does is it keeps it at this one temperature, as opposed to the way I made these by hand with the kettle. You know, by the time I was done, the temperature dropped significantly.
So what's the ideal temperature? Ish.
It depends on the coffee. I tend to stay around the 205-degree range, but some coffees I've had at 205, they're like, this is weird. I dropped the temperature a bit, and it was like, just open it up. The science of it, I don't exactly know, but I just know that.
Michael?
Yeah, no, that's exactly, for some reason, some coffees, it's kind of like from 195 to 205, and we'd have to have Peter Giuliano here to explain that.
To explain how that works.
You need the guy with two PhDs.
Okay. And so you're writing this article. Can you shed some light on what it's about?
Oh, I'm writing an article about this company, Larmazoco, that makes these very beautiful, exquisite espresso machines that are handmade in a factory outside of Florence, and everything is polished by hand.
Isn't Larmazoco a lion? I remember
that. Yeah, it's a lion. And this company has been around for 90 years. They actually did a lot of the innovations that shape modern. What's interesting about it is that they have had a huge impact on the way we drink espresso now. They started, for example, two boilers, so that one for the steam for the milk and one for the coffee, so that you could maintain temperature control. The other thing they did, though, is aesthetic, and a lot of espresso making is aesthetic. They turned the machine, they turned the boiler horizontal, so that when you're having a shot pulled by a really skilled barista, you can see, you can see each other, because there's not this big boiler separating your face from his face or her face. So
didn't we have a Marzocco in?
No, we did not.
What was that?
That was a Lavazza, right?
Well,
Lavazza, is that they make coffee makers?
Lavazza, yeah, it was Lavazza.
They make coffee makers in Italy. Yeah. Yep. But it was in a house we were in.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it was
Lavazza. Yeah.
But the coffee was really good. So
yeah.
Okay, tell us quickly about the last coffee we're drinking.
This is one that's it's not even on the menu yet. We just picked it up. It's called the Kigoma. And funny thing is, I'm tasting it for the first time along
with
you
all. Okay, and is this also from?
Also counterculture, also Burundi.
Burundi. Yes. Now, have you been to Burundi?
Yes, I've been to Burundi.
Fascinating.
It's a kind of scary place.
Where does one stay in Burundi? I'm just curious.
You stay in the kind of hotel that you take a sleeping pill when you go into the room. You stay in a hotel that has two, where the hot water and the cold water, there are two spigots, but only one kind of water, and it's cold.
Okay, so no field trip to Burundi coming up anytime soon.
People are awfully nice.
Okay, what were you expecting out of this cup? What were you hoping for?
Based on the boozy, I've had that for a couple weeks now. So I was just going to compare it to the boozy, just see if it had the same kind of like tea notes, the same kind of tangerine-ish kind of notes, the citrus notes that are kind of in there. And it's something there. I still get tea in that one, some black tea in that one, but then there's something else too.
Your educated palate just kill me.
It's a more pale version though, right?
Yeah.
It's less vivid than the first one.
Yeah, the first one.
There's a hint of it. It's not like...
The first one was really... it popped in your mouth.
Yeah.
Exactly. It had a really rich smell. I mean, as a not an avid coffee drinker, I do love that. Like, there's nothing like walking in and smelling beans being ground. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such an experience, and it's, you know, it smells so good, and you
it's kind of like those goats, you know, it's intoxicating. Coffee. But isn't it? I mean, it is. It's like
Chicaldi.
It is intoxicating.
Well, so on that note, we're going to have to wrap up.
First of all, when you come to the Line Hotel, you got to go to the cup we all race for.
And say hi to Reggie.
Reggie's a cool guy.
Let him make you a cup of coffee.
That's right. I love making coffee.
I would hope so.
I love making it more than drinking it, actually.
And Michael, aside from the article, what have you got out there we should plug?
God in a Cup.
Right.
Well, God in a Cup. Well, I know. It's been out since 2008.
Right. So. Well, I'm doing a bunch of profiles for the Washington Post right now, and I'm working on another book, but we can't plug that because it's not done yet. No, it's still in bloody
birth. What kind of profiles?
Well, I did one on Francis Lamb, who took over the Splendid Table. And
it was in the Post 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
It was fabulous. And
I'm available in case.
David wants you to write a profile. Right. Can you do it so this way I have an obituary for later?
Wait. Right. Well,
you know, that's funny because she said, I think you should be heavily insured. All right. Well, that kind of wraps it up for Industry Night here on Full Service Radio. And I guess I'm going to my death, so this will be
we'll take one last sip.
Take one last sip. And next week, we're going to be joined from the team from Chapel Hill Farm. We're going to be talking about Randall Lineback cows.
That beef Moo. Is awesomeness.
Thanks for joining us. Industry Night with David and Nikki Nellis at the Line Hotel.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.